Welcome. This is Dr. Wes Fisher, here to discuss atrial fibrillation. So your doctor tells you you have atrial fibrillation. A myriad of questions circle through your head. What is atrial fibrillation or AFib? Where did it come from? Why do I need to be on this blood thinner called Coumadin? What options are there for treating this heart rhythm disorder? And will a pacemaker correct or control this rhythm? Do I need a surgical procedure? And my doctor, gosh, he mentioned I have atrial flutter. How is this different from atrial fibrillation? Etc., etc., etc. Well, after treating many patients with atrial fibrillation, I can tell you that there's only one thing that is true. Everyone is a bit different. Different in how they perceive their atrial fibrillation, different in how they respond to medications, and different in what I recommend to them regarding therapy. This brief tutorial is basically what I tell patients in my practice about atrial fibrillation. I find it often takes an hour or so to explain the intricacies of the disease, and certainly we do not have that kind of time here on this podcast to be able to review everything about atrial fibrillation. But at least I can begin to open the dialogue and help you understand perhaps how doctors often think about what therapeutic options to recommend to their patients. And hopefully with this discourse you will be able to decide for yourself. There is one important disclaimer, however, that I must say, and you should not use this information as your sole resource or recommendation regarding your care. You still need to seek care with your primary physician, your cardiologist, or your cardiac electrophysiologist or heart rhythm specialist, and work with them to assure that the proper care is delivered for your atrial fibrillation specific to your needs. Now, having gotten that out of the way, let's talk about atrial fibrillation. To understand atrial fibrillation, one must first understand how the heart beats normally. You see, the heart has four chambers. The two upper chambers are called the atria, and the two bottom chambers are called the ventricles. The upper right atrium happens to be where the normal heart rhythm arises. A specialized group of cells in this area fire automatically between 60 and 100 times per minute, typically, and the electrical activation from the upper atria spreads evenly from that initial spot within the right atrium across both atria, but it can't get through to the lower chambers because it's insulated from them by the fibrous valve rings that separate the top and bottom chambers of your heart. Except at one spot, and this one spot is called the AV node. Now, the AV node's job is unique in that it is specialized to slow the conduction slightly before it allows it to proceed down specialized conducting fibers to the lower chambers. It is this ability of the AV node to slow conduction that allows time for blood to physically move from the top to bottom chambers. The AV node then acts as a governor, if you will, that regulates and limits how fast the lower chamber or main pumping chambers of the heart can contract. Now, in atrial fibrillation, we believe that many of the impulses begin in the upper left atrium, where the veins that return oxygenated blood from the lungs enter, and these veins are called the pulmonary veins. In people with atrial fibrillation, we believe that there are cells immediately within or adjacent to the pulmonary veins that fire extremely quickly, between 250 and 500 beats per minute. It is this rapid and intermittent firing that causes the rest of the atria to become very disturbed, and multiple electrical wavelets occur within the atria, causing a disorganized contraction process. These multiple wavelets bombard the AV node at an irregular interval and cause the irregularity of the pulse that one feels in atrial fibrillation because of the variable timing between each of the heartbeats that is transmitted from the top to bottom chambers of the heart. So, what are your therapeutic options with atrial fibrillation? The appropriate therapy probably is based first and foremost on your symptoms. All patients with atrial fibrillation should always receive also some form of anticoagulation. Patients with structurally normal hearts, as determined by echocardiography or an echo study to image the wall motion of the heart, and those that have no associated risk factors that might be treated with aspirin alone. What are these risk factors? Well, they include age equal to or greater than 75, diabetes, history of hypertension, history of prior stroke, or a history of a weakened heart muscle or narrowing of the mitral valve, the valve that is between the left atrium and left ventricle. In these patients, we feel these patients have very high risk of stroke and recommend the blood thinner warfarin or Coumadin therapy for them. In patients who have completely structurally normal hearts, there may be a place for aspirin therapy, but this should be discussed with your physician directly. Now back to symptoms. The treatment strategies are generally based on three sets of symptoms: patients with fast, irregular rhythms, patients with slow, symptomatic rhythms, or those patients who have absolutely no symptoms whatsoever. For patients with symptoms of fast, irregular rhythms during periods of atrial fibrillation, whether this is felt or not, the following therapies exist. One is a rate control medicine to slow the heart rate down, and these include such drugs as digoxin, beta blockers, including metoprolol, atenolol, inderol, carvedilol, or calcium channel blockers, such as diltiazem or verapamil. These drugs just control the heart rate during periods of atrial fibrillation and are not known to necessarily convert atrial fibrillation back to normal rhythm. The other set of drugs that are sometimes used are rhythm control medications. These are primary antiarrhythmic medications, including such drugs as flecainide, sotalol, propafenone, dofetilide, or amiodarone. These drugs are used to maintain normal rhythm or to convert the rhythm from atrial fibrillation back to normal rhythm. These drugs have considerably more side effects than rate control drugs and are at best 50 to 60% effective in prospective randomized trials at preventing episodes of atrial fibrillation. Because of this relatively poor efficacy rate, anticoagulation is recommended to continue even while on these medications to reduce the risk of stroke. Another therapy is cardioversion. This is where a brief external but powerful shock is applied to the chest to restore the atrial fibrillation back to normal. This is done under a general anesthetic and is usually done as the same-day procedure when you come into the hospital, are briefly put to sleep. The large shock is applied across your chest to restore the rhythm to normal, and then you're allowed to awaken. Approximately 90% of patients will have a recurrence of atrial fibrillation, however, despite undergoing this procedure. Nonetheless, if your episodes of atrial fibrillation are very infrequent, such as annually or so, this might be an acceptable form of therapy. Additionally, if you are one of those lucky 10% of patients in whom the sinus rhythm is maintained, it is a simple, reasonably low-risk procedure to undergo. The next procedure for patients with fast rhythm is catheter ablation, and this is where the heart rhythm specialist, called a cardiac electrophysiologist, can try to map where within the heart where the initiating focus of atrial fibrillation is occurring and apply a series of a series of wires inside the heart under local anesthesia in various locations, and then move a specialized steerable wire within the left atrium. This wire allows cautery to be applied or small electrical burns to be applied around each of the pulmonary veins in an attempt to insulate them from the rest of the atrium. If this is successful, people can be rendered free of atrial fibrillation. It is important, however, to understand that with the current technologies that are available today, the best efficacy rates are between 70 and 80%, and approximately 20 to 30% of patients require a redo operation to achieve that success rate. Needless to say, this is not the usual first step approach that most doctors use, although it is gaining popularity and is being performed in more and more centers across the United States. It is estimated that in 2004, 10,000 of these procedures were performed within the United States, and by 2007, approximately 100,000 atrial fibrillation ablations will be performed. The most important thing, however, to remember about atrial fibrillation ablation is that there are no prospective randomized trials determining that it is more likely to help you live longer if you undergo that procedure than if you were to be treated with medical therapy. This trial has yet to be performed. So the patients who should be referred for atrial fibrillation ablation should be those who are highly symptomatic and have failed drug therapy. The final form of procedure that can be performed for patients with atrial fibrillation is the implantation of a permanent pacemaker and a cauterization or ablation of the AV node wire that connects the top and bottom chambers. The problem with this procedure is it renders patients pacemaker dependent for the rest of their life, but approximately 85% of patients who have failed all of the therapies mentioned before have found that this particular therapy can render them without symptoms of the irregularity of the heartbeat and often causes an improvement in symptoms, particularly in those who have side effects from medications previously tried. It is also critically important to remember that even though you undergo an implantation of a permanent pacemaker and ablation of the AV node, because after that is performed, patients do not perceive whether they are in atrial fibrillation or not, Coumadin must be continued indefinitely. Now, for people with very slow heart rhythms during atrial fibrillation that become symptomatic, such as nearly passing out or experiencing intermittent lightheadedness, implantation of a permanent pacemaker and anticoagulation is probably adequate therapy in this group of patients. This is particularly good for patients who have intermittent atrial fibrillation that stops and is followed by prolonged pauses. And many patients find that pacemakers are useful for alleviating their symptoms. However, with pacemakers, Coumadin must be continued to assure adequate anticoagulation and stroke risk reduction. While pacemakers are useful devices, they too have their own set of occasional operative risks involved during their installation, such as lead dislodgement, infection, cardiac perforation, or the need for reoperation due to inadequate functioning of the device. And it will require lifelong follow-up to assure proper functioning and intermittent battery changes every 5 to 7 years. Nonetheless, these reasons should not preclude this procedure if it's deemed that the symptom improvement gained by doing the procedure outweighs the risks of doing it. And finally, for patients with no symptoms and no excessively fast or slow heart rate, anticoagulation alone is probably adequate therapy. A landmark NIH-sponsored trial called the AFFIRM trial was the largest randomized controlled trial of 4,060 patients sponsored by the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute of the National Institute of Health. And it was a very important trial that helped doctors understand that elderly patients over the age of 65 and with no known history of heart valve disease could live as well or perhaps even slightly better than with a lower risk of stroke and death by just anticoagulating them and not trying to restore the rhythm to normal using cardioversion, catheter ablation, or medical therapies. It was important that patients on anticoagulation with warfarin be carefully maintained with a blood thinning level, also called an INR, or international normalized ratio, of 2 to 3. Patients with artificial heart valves should have a slightly higher value, probably between 2.5 and 3.5. What does this INR mean when it's 2 to 3? It means that it takes 2 to 3 times the normal amount of time to clot your blood as a normal control. INR levels over 4 are associated with a significantly increased risk of bleeding. In summary, then, we have talked at length about atrial fibrillation, what its causes are, where we believe it arises from, and the various therapies based primarily on the symptoms that you experience. Whether your heart rhythm is fast, slow, or you have no idea what if you're in atrial fibrillation or not. These different types of symptoms will dictate what the proper therapy will be recommended on your behalf. I hope today's podcast has helped clarify some of the logic behind why physicians pick certain therapies. And certainly, we have been unable to touch in this short period of time on the various modalities, particularly catheter ablation, which are now being reported with an increased rate of cure with this disorder. Because of time constraints of this podcast, we will be unable to delve into the fine points of catheter ablation for atrial fibrillation with this podcast. But stay tuned. We'll make sure that we have another podcast up soon describing that procedure, its risks, benefits, and alternatives at length. And hopefully, it will answer further questions. There is a effort on my behalf to make sure that the data are non-biased and are offered to you from credible sources within the medical literature. Further information regarding the context, along with images and diagrams regarding atrial fibrillation, can be found at the www.medtees.com website. That's MEDTEES.com, and click on the tutorial section, and you'll find the atrial fibrillation tutorial there. Additional links to other sites, which also include information regarding atrial fibrillation, are also included in that tutorial. This is Dr. Wes Fisher completing this podcast on atrial fibrillation, its mechanisms, and treatment strategies. I hope you find it's helpful, and I wish you a healthy and happy heartbeat.